Hello and welcome.
I gave it back to you.
Yeah.
I didn't steal the welcome. That's your signature.
It is. This is Pat.
This is Garrett.
And you are currently listening to episode 13 of the 8123 podcast.
Thank you for all the new. This is for all the new listeners.
Yeah,
there's probably some new ones out there.
Yeah,
I think the last one might have been one of our bigger.
Yeah,
bigger podcasts.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for listening. It's crazy that we have 13 already because it seems like we're just getting started. So
yeah, 13's not that much, Pat.
No, it's not. But like. It's a lot better than zero.
It's true.
Think about how many people have zero podcast episodes done.
Oh my God. So many.
And we have
most people.
We have 13. it's a start.
Then you listen to Joe Rogan, he's like at like 2,000.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a lot. That's a lot of talking. That's a lot of information. His are like 3 hours long. Oh. Ours are like
it makes your brain hurt.
Yeah. Oh.
this one was one of the earlier ones that we've done, and we are posting it now. Sean Silverman of the Technicolors and formerly of the Century.
Yes, a lot of this talk is about the Century.
Yeah,
and we kind of get into. He went to our first show ever, so we talk about that. We talk about signing to a major label with them,
going on tour together a bunch, and just kind of like. Pretty much building what 8123 is with this Century.
Yeah.
And with like Sean kind of being the head of that band, I guess you could say. So there's just tons of history that we have together and he's
not to mention he's
one
my
of our
roommate.
Best friends. Yeah.
He's my roommate, so yeah. That was nice.
Yeah, so it was an awesome chat.
Good talks.
Yeah, we're currently home. Back home. I feel like we've been home a lot, but we're
I'm not jet lagged anymore.
Yeah, yeah. That's good. We're finally in the studio with the entire band.
Yes, which took 2 months to happen.
Took a long time to happen. But it's good and it feels good and like things are like are working well and
those fucking assholes. No one said thank you to us, by the way.
We set up
the whole thing, and we were talking about it's like it just is working, and no one like thought about how it's working.
And it
fucking dicks.
It took a lot of effort.
Yeah, hours and hours. Whatever. They don't listen to this anyway, so we can talk shit.
Yeah. this is the beginning of the end of the main.
Maybe.
So but. Yeah, so we're going to be doing that. We're going to be in the studio. That's pretty much it.
Nothing in particular.
It's your birthday party soon.
It is.
You're having a NBA Jam theme birthday party, which is fun.
Yeah, well, my girlfriend's setting that up. That was her idea, and I said, hey, sure, let's do that. I want to find NBA Jam, the actual game.
To have at the party?
Yeah.
For people to play?
That would be fun.
Yeah, you can find it. Mm-hmm. I mean, even if you have to order it like on Amazon tonight, and then you can
that.
get it by then.
That's a good thought. Yeah. I have Prime. I just got Prime, so I'll get here tomorrow.
Yeah.
Sweet.
But cool. Well, we hope everyone had a happy Valentine's Day, even if you're alone and sad.
Yeah, you're allowed to. What a shitty holiday.
Oh, it's fucking terrible.
It's so stupid.
I mean. I guess this is the thing, is, like, I think it is and it isn't at the same time. Like, it is because, like, it's just a made-up thing to make a bunch of money. But then at the same time, it's, like, it's a nice thought for, like, people that generally don't have it in them to
be
a nice person to somebody that they care about. It's at least maybe giving them an opportunity to be forced into it.
See, that's not good.
I don't think that's good.
That's
not good.
The card companies are taking money from you, your flowers and bullshit, and then you have to think that you need to do something on this one day.
Yeah. All right. I take it back.
Call him bullshit on it.
It sucks.
It's a sucky day.
But you're gonna do something for your girlfriend on that day.
We're going to a movie.
See.
So, but we go to movies all the time.
Yeah, I know, but like, you knew what you're doing, you know.
I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, so it's the one time you're not just going and doing something random. It's like, oh, you planned this yesterday. Cool.
All right.
I'll stop complaining.
Enjoy
this
the episode.
One's for all the lovebirds.
We're going to talk to Sean from the Central and the Technicolor.
Guy from
this
no
like,
way.
Yeah, I was like, do you ball? He's like, I've been known to ball.
Fuck
which
yeah.
Which is like,
that's everybody though. Yeah, like
no,
yo,
but what does that mean?
See, yeah, he could also be
like,
really good.
I couldn't say that before
like,
I balled.
Who knows? It's
oh,
like
man. I hope he's better than
like,
us.
Like, I didn't ball before this ball.
Ew. No, I watched shooting videos today. That's
oh,
the
yeah.
level I'm at this point.
Of like
form and how to shoot proper and
yeah.
how to get better at
See,
shooting.
You've done that for years now.
Huh?
Since we've started you've talked about
I watch it cuz not only I learn nothing from it. I just like watching other people shoot well.
Flick, right? You got to
It's
flick.
A
yeah.
wrist thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
You're
I've
like
noticed
getting inspired.
I have heard the things you've talked about and it's like, "Oh, having the elbow straight or whatever."
Yeah.
Fuck.
But it's like
and
every YouTube video ever where it's more about the idea of thinking you understood the video and telling other people you got it than it is actually like following through with it.
See, I'm learning via you. Like, I'm not watching the videos. I'm watching you watch the videos.
Yeah, that's... Well, like, I'm instructing you as though I'm now the coach.
You're the pro.
I'm now Steve Nash. Oh, so I watched Steve Nash for 10 minutes, so let me tell you how Steve Nash does it. And then, okay. And therefore, you'll know how to be like Steve
I
Nash.
I mean, you did win the
and
game winning
you're
going to
be as good as...
Yeah. You won the game last
Yeah,
week.
Mostly from because of Steve Nash.
Thank you, Steve.
All right, so what's the advice from
Steve Nash?
Nash?
It's mainly it's all about that wrist thing and like getting your arms higher than you think, like above your shoulder, so that you you know you really get that like full extension. Because otherwise, you're shooting with your arm. And again, I don't do any of those things, but that's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah. I just I throw it and hope magic happens and it goes in.
Yeah,
that's all I'm trying to do. And I'm pretty much guard pad as hard as I possibly can.
Yeah, there's no like there's no feeling that changes from when you do it the first time and you miss it. Like when you get it in and then feeling it like you've got it figured out. Like you don't have like there's no learning curve for me.
No.
It's, every time I get it in it feels
it's
just as
chaos.
Good as the last
yeah.
time.
Pure chaos. Did you play much basketball in New York, Sean?
That's all I did.
Did yeah. you?
No. Actually, baseball. It's all baseball. Basketball.
Are, yeah.
Yeah, well, in the area I was in, it was all baseball when we were growing up. It was always Little League, Travel League, baseball,
and
baseball,
you did all
baseball.
That?
Always.
You
I was,
traveled?
Yeah, I played baseball in high school.
I did not. Oh, you have told me that.
I'm a high school baseball phenom, you know? Or not at all. JV.
What?
Know.
So you're Brooklyn.
I'm Brooklyn. No, basketball was huge, but the thing is that I was so – it's see, baseball is a sport where if you're short, it's okay. Basketball is a sport where you are at a extreme disadvantage for being tiny.
Yeah. Because
then it's down to you and, like, five other tiny guys.
Yeah.
And then you got to be the best of – you've got to be so good to be, like –
You just have to be able to shoot.
You got to be able to shoot. So then it becomes, will I get to ever play? And then you just sit and watch other people play
and the
a
answer
lot.
Is, yeah, no, yeah. Unless you start an emo league.
Yeah.
Phoenix.
And then it happens all the time.
So what? So you moved to Arizona when?
I moved to Arizona in the middle of my junior year of high school. So right when you start
That's a big move.
Yeah, it was the best dumb
terrible.
Move of all time. It was like, hey, you know how you don't have any friends? Would you like to have zero friends again?
Yeah.
Let's move you right in the middle of high school. So yeah, I came out here and spent a whole year just pretending as though I was like I was new guy for like a good 6 months.
Had you been already playing guitar?
Yeah. So in New York, I'd basically been kind of I was always like trying to find my way into music. Without understanding what the heck it was or why, how songwriting worked or any of that stuff. I was like, I would always help out my music teacher. I had this teacher in my freshman year of high school when I was in Brooklyn, and he basically said, if you will tune guitars during your lunch period, all the guitars, they had all these classical guitars, if you tune every single one, I will basically give you instruction and I'll give you like credit, but you can like hang around and like play guitar as much as you want. Mm-hmm. So instead of going to lunch every day, I would tune, you know, 40 classical guitars so that the kids could play on them, and he would teach me, and that's how I kind of got like free instruction in high school. That's the only like time I got in guitar instruction was during that time.
So your dad didn't teach you?
No, I hated it. My dad is an excellent musician and great guitar player, but the idea of him showing it to me made me miserable.
Because it's your dad.
It's so
dad is doing it.
Yeah, it's like, yeah. Hey, dad, come and show me this thing. And I immediately rebelled against that. That was my gift when I was 10 years old was a guitar, and I threw it in the closet because he tried showing me what to do with it.
Yeah.
And so then it became. Then what happened was I learned a Green Day song on it by myself, and
Which
then it was
one?
Like.
Brain Stew?
Brain Stew.
Of course.
Nice.
Yeah.
Brain Stew. And then once you learn Brain Stew, then you might as well learn the rest of the songs.
Yeah.
So then, yeah, that's how I kind of got into it.
But did you grow up going to his shows?
No. See, that's the bummer is I think I like ruined that for him. I think my birth is the reason he didn't have the band is me existing, which is weird when you think about it, because you'd think it'd be like, well, now I got the kid. He's going to get to see me do the stuff.
Yeah, I could be
no,
cool guy.
Reverse. It was like, no. I do it. Then it was like zero of that.
Because he had an actual band.
He had a real band.
They made
a
record and everything.
They were
right?
called, oh, at the time, the band was called Dear France, and they were like a real band, a real thing, trying to make it in music. And wow. He was like doing it. And I still, to this day, his record is like, one of the first records I've ever heard, like outside of like, yeah. Like it's like Led Zeppelin, The Who, Dear Friends, or like my three records.
But was it like, was it not cool for you, or was it, were you like, that's fucking tight?
I thought it was the coolest thing ever. We thought it was like, it seemed like magic. You know, I think that's like the more so than the idea of hearing like, a lot of the music he showed me for the first time. Mm-hmm. Like his big influence on me was like showing me progressive music from like the 70s. That's what I grew up on. That's all I knew was like these bands, King Crimson and Genesis and Jethro Tull, and kind of just putting that out there. And that, but the thing was, is a lot of those artists were like very progressive and hard to maybe listen to for someone who was nine and 10 years old.
Yeah.
But his record was really poppy and wonderful and really catchy. And so, knowing that he created it, it felt like, how is that possible? How could he do that?
Yeah.
And that idea came through hearing his record than hearing like Led Zeppelin for the first time. Mm-hmm. Even though Led Zeppelin, you know, in its own right, had such a big influence on my life, not in the same way of like songwriting.
Yeah.
You know, like actually the idea of a song existing in the universe seemed possible by hearing his record. So,
yeah.
Because
yeah. There's elements of pop and whatever. Which,
yeah, which I think is like...
Weren't they like kind of a Hall and Oates kind of?
Yeah, they were kind of like... They weren't yacht rocky. They were definitely on the like new wave side of 80s music. Like definitely had that Hall and Oates element. And they definitely had like the kind of like blue-eyed soul kind mm-hmm. of thing going on. Which is funny because to this day, it's like I think that's why I've always kind of sought out that kind of music is because... of that record sounding kind of like my dad's records.
Yeah.
You know, like it's, and even to this day, like songs I've written before, I'll catch myself and go like, I feel like if I just change the production a little bit, I'm in Dear France again. You know?
That's amazing. Was, all right. So as like you joined bands and you, things like you guys started playing shows and like had a little bit of an audience and stuff. What was your dad like, hey, this is super hard, like what the fuck are you doing, or did it feel like he was like fucking do it, like
he was literally could not have been. See, that's the nice thing is I was fortunate enough, I think, to have this like freedom that sometimes people are like, oh, you need the, you know, the catalyst for like all these great things, or that you had something to work up against, right? Mm-hmm. And that when you get the support, it's almost like counterproductive because you have nothing to write against. But I think I had plenty of that in other ways to write against that I didn't. I think that having supportive parents really actually nurtured it, because he was like, you know, fuck it. You don't want to go to school. You want to do it, then do it. But don't do it. Do it as much. Yeah. You just can't do it, you know, 20% less than you would do something else. It can't be hobby. But there was never doubt. And I think that the idea that
which is kind of crazy, like seeing that he was trying to do what you were doing and didn't get there.
It was almost as though I didn't like I blocked out, and I don't even call it to him. He might see it and go, maybe that was like a failure in that sense. But like, to me, I didn't see it as a failure. I saw it as like,
my dad made a record
and he like did it. And like, that means I can do it. It almost gives you permission. It's almost like now I have the blueprint of kind of doing those things and him not having a reason to say no, you know, because it's like, well, dad did it, you know?
Yeah.
And my mom was a musician, and music is just so like in the bloodstream that I don't think anyone ever pushed against the idea of it being like, if I could dream it up and go for it, then no one was going to like hinder that in any way, you know. Mm-hmm. Outside family, yes, yeah, very much so. Everyone else, yeah, but them, very supportive. So
yeah. And then Alex, your brother, was it always like you guys were going to be in a band as the brothers, or did you like not, you're like, oh, I don't want to be in a band with my little brother?
I think it's kind of this thing that happens with brothers where you, or maybe I don't think it's always the case, but often the case where your brother, you kind of like, especially with an age gap, a little bit of an age gap, it becomes like your brother gets your friends or vice versa, absorbs into it, depending on who's the younger one or the older one.
Yep.
And so for the longest time, Alex was always around my friends, always playing with older kids, always wanting to be around. And he figured out, he went through a process of having to like navigate that a lot quicker than I had to, just because of that. And so when I started learning guitar, the first thing I did, I never thought of myself as like guitar player ever. Even when I started playing it, it was only like, how do I use this thing to make other things? I never wanted to learn guitar to like learn leads or learn. I only wanted to learn to know how to get to the next thing.
Yeah.
And so with Alex, I was like,
kind of the opposite of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so with Alex, I was literally like, you need to learn this so I can do the thing. Like, you need to do it because I know I have enough, I can manipulate you enough to convince you that this is a good enough idea that you'll do it so that I can get closer to the thing. It was pretty selfish, but in retrospect, it was like,
made his technical ability is insane.
So he started playing bass, you know, 3 years before I started playing guitar. He was like 7 or 8 years old when he started playing bass.
Wow.
Which bass for a younger person, I think oftentimes is like
boring.
It's very hard to like get excited about playing bass.
Totally.
And so having him around kind of just was like phase two of me being able to figure out, okay, well, if he does this thing, then I can do songs, you know. So yeah, and what's funny is like he, right after that, the next thing that happened was my dad, which to this day probably the smartest thing he could have ever done for me, was he could tell that I wanted to write songs. He could tell that I was like trying to figure it out, but I couldn't like place it yet and figure it out or do whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And he bought me a recording, an 8-track Zoom recorder when I was like 12, you know, which is really early to start doing. No. And at that time everyone was doing sports. So it was like, it was my thing. It gave me like a sense of identity for myself, even though I didn't show anyone. And that I think was like the reason why, like, it was like, oh, Alex, come play on this. Oh, Alex, come do this. And we would kind of like work within each other and, you know, screw up the recorder for a while until but it was the idea of being able to play over yourself and have the collaboration was so magical. It was so special that it just like kind of pushed everything forward a lot quicker than it probably would have otherwise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, so then you move to Arizona, you eventually meet Joel.
I meet Ryan first. Okay. I meet Ryan through another band. I form a different band. I met Ryan through a Craigslist ad. which it makes so much sense. Yeah. And the funny thing is the band that we started, when we went and met him at his house to play drums, I couldn't stand him for a minute because I was just like, he had kind of like a cockiness to him, mm-hmm. and that like bothered me. I was like, I don't want to work with this guy. This guy seems like he's already got stuff figured out. And then come to find out that we were the only ones that could write music in the project. Mm-hmm. And we actually really like found this like kinship in terms of our backgrounds and like the music we listened to. And then that kind of happened. And then Alex actually was next. Joel was actually the last kind of thing. We were the three piece for a while. Because one, Alex was really young at the time, and so our biggest concern was like, well, we can't play bars. Yeah. We won't be able to play bars. He's only 16. We'll have to leave. And so we need to find an older singer so that we can like kind of disguise Alex in the band as an older guy,
yeah.
so that we could play clubs and play shows. And so Alex found Joel through a high school, like a kind of just seeing him sing in high school by himself. Like and just came up to him and was like, hey, you should audition for my brother's band.
Wow.
And then we had already gone through like four singers, and some of which have gone on to do other things. One was this girl who ended up being this wonderful costume designer who does like the craziest, most amazing costumes. And this other guy used to be in this project called The Medic Droid.
Yeah.
He auditioned for us. And there were like two other, we had so many singers. And then when we saw Joel, we were like, okay, yeah, this is the closest thing we've had to a unit in a year. And it kind of was like really instant. We didn't really, there was no like formal, like you're in the band. It was like, let's write songs.
Yeah.
And it was just like assumed. And then that's kind of how it happened.
And so. What bands were you into at that time, like what were the influences for the early this century?
Because you guys had like a funk, not like a but like it was like funky.
Well, before there was like the funky thing before the funky like when we came into it, we were listening to like the thing that that we got into was like kind of the progressive side of things. Like we were really into like if we could think of like contemporary, like Circus Survive was really big for us,
mm-hmm.
which is really you know, and Cursive. And like some of these other artists where they were kind of left of center of different scenes, like could fit into some scenes and not in others. And so that was really intriguing. And it was very musical.
Yep.
So like that was the big thing. And I think that's why funk then came into it. It was like it was still musical.
Yeah.
And Alex is just, my brother is just so naturally funky as a musician that it just seemed very natural. So then that kind of became the thing. And we were listening to Maroon 5 all the time. And, you know, that became a big, and Earth, Wind & Fire to name other, you know, not so contemporary. But yeah, that's where what's kind of what we wanted to be, or what we aspired to be. Because
like for me, when I first heard you, like I wouldn't have picked out any of those bands. Like I thought that you guys wouldn't have been listening to any like contemporary bands and like trying to like, you know, like the fact that you've listened to Circus Survive.
Yeah.
To me, like doesn't feel like what I would have thought you would have been, you know.
Totally. I think what was cool was like for a lot of like what I realized about myself over time was that the things that I was finding intriguing about songwriting, I didn't realize until after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
Like the thing that now I realize why I was so into Circus Survive was that a lot of what I do when I'm writing is I'm trying to like connect with the singer as much as possible to get in the headspace of like what would breed the most out of them, bring the most out of them, you know? And so with Circa, I was like, here's this guy who sings higher than everyone else, who's got these beautiful, pretty melodies over very intricate music.
Yeah.
That idea, I think subconsciously was like clarifying me like, hey, here's an artist that was able to find a center with a singer that is like very offset from the musicality of the band. And that was like, oh, maybe that's why secretly I think I felt that. I felt connected to it because it's like, I feel like our band related to that, you know?
Yeah.
Which is really weird. But you know, then it was just like, I like this.
Yeah,
do you like this?
It's so funny to try and like, when you start a band, it's not like you're like, I don't think, do people are like, we're going to do this. I feel like it's like kind of, you play, and then whatever happens, like I'm saying, like your first band,
sure,
just like pick up a guitar, go, and then whatever happens, like okay, and then someone's like, you sound like that,
Sure.
And then you're like, yeah, I guess we'll keep sounding like that.
Yeah. I think that there's like such a lack of self-identification that's wonderful. That's like what's beautiful about
it. I remember someone told us that we sound like the Replacements. And this is after our second song that we'd ever had. And not one of us had ever even heard of the Replacements.
That's
the best. And then... But then, like, then you start, like, listening to the Replacements.
Yeah,
then,
we're the Replacements.
Or like, the same thing with, like, Tom Petty. I mean, obviously, like, we had heard songs and stuff, but, like, none of us were, like, digging into his catalog.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, it's like...
Yeah, during Can't Stop, which is so weird.
It's like, you guys sound like Tom Petty. It's like,
sure.
We were, like, listening to, like, Cute Is What We Aim For, but, like, sure, I guess if you if you say we sound like Tom Petty, and then you just run with it.
Totally.
Like, and then your next record sounds like Tom Petty.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. It's, like, the minute, and this is what I've really come to find, even, like, writing now, is, like, the minute someone else identifies you, and the minute someone gives you a value greater than maybe even what you thought, it becomes, like, somewhere embedded in your brain that is part of your identity now. And that's something that I think happens when you're younger. As you get older, you're able to filter in a different way. But when I remember when everyone was like, yeah, you guys are really funky. Yeah. You should keep doing funky stuff. And not to be like, oh, that's what I'm going to do. But somewhere in the back of your mind, you're like, you get the validation. And so much of early songwriting is validation basically being your friends thinking it's cool.
Yeah.
And if your friends think it's cool, whether or not you're like, oh, I just want to do it, I'm just doing it for me, there's the sense of validation that comes with it that like creeps into the songwriting early on because you don't know how to necessarily always filter that out because it just becomes part of you. It's like, well, so-and-so's in that song was really good, so maybe we need to like think about it for a second.
You need that. You just need some sort of support because you're so self-conscious doing it. And you're like, if someone's like, that's cool, it's like, fuck, let's run with that. Go.
Sure. Yeah, I also don't think you realize how vulnerable you're being at certain times. And then you have to expose that vulnerability. And it's so scary. Mm-hmm. You know, there's like a fear to that. I think the biggest thing that we had overcome for the longest time when we were first starting the Century was that I had a hard time being talking about myself through writing. It was easy to talk in third person or character or writing for somebody else because I didn't really feel like my story was relatable because I felt like the story that I was wanting to tell was just way too this or that or too dark. And so I was so fearful of it that I didn't write the types of songs that I wanted to early on because it felt too personal, you know, so it's easier to just like show someone something and be able to detach from it. You know, you could play them a song and be like, oh, if they didn't like it, you'd be like, yeah, it's just a stupid song. We were just like messing around and whatever. And you can distance yourself from it, you know, to almost preserve yourself from the criticism.
What it, I guess kind of along those lines is throughout the entire career of the Century, I mean, you were writing songs and writing words.
Yeah.
But Joel was the one who had to put that out into the world and like sing it in a way. Was that a challenging thing for you to like do that? I mean,
yeah, no, it was kind of the best education for me on how to write songs because what it did was it created this like real challenge, which was, you know, I now have this person who I can bounce ideas off of and create this story with who I can project and not have to reveal much of myself necessarily in the way I would want to, but then also having to, you know, figure out how to like get in someone's psyche and understand and empathize. Like, I think the biggest trait of a great songwriter or like a co-writer in my experience is like being able to empathize and listening way more than you're performing or writing. Mm-hmm. Like the biggest hurdle we always had was that Joel and I came from very different life experiences growing up. You know, he like our households were very different. Our upbringing was very different and no better nor worse. They're very like good and bad for different reasons. But when we would work together, it had this weird thing where it was like, I would say something, maybe it was a little on the far left side of things. And Joel would have to like rationalize that with his background. And that was a really unusual challenge that I never, that I didn't know differently. Like, I didn't know another way to do it. Yeah. So that was what I assumed it was how it worked, always. Mm. And so for a long time, it was just figuring out how do we, what's the writing chemistry? What's the, how do we connect with each other without, and be this far apart from each other philosophically at times, but then also really together on certain things because of that and understanding. And that's what I learned to like empathize and be like, oh, wait a second. If I just listen to this perspective, I'm going to gain insight into understanding other people's stories better, writing stronger, being able to tap into something and be like, oh, this is relatable now to mm-hmm. me. And I can like find something in my experience that connects in the same way. You know, that was the hard part.
Would you write for him or are you writing you and it just
kind of a mixture of both? I think as time went on, it was easier. Like, I feel like once you build a rhythm up with people after a little bit, you can write in there. I can almost hear, like, I can picture how Joel sings things or how he would say things. Mm-hmm. I have like, there's like a vocabulary. Everyone has like their own vocabulary, their own slang.
Yeah.
And Joel had his own slang. So I knew certain things that he would say and it made it easier to like tap into that. But he also, you know, he would definitely write with me later on a lot because I wanted it to feel connected. I think it's so important. And he had stuff to say. I just think I was trying to bring that out. And then sometimes I would just have a thing and be like, I think this is more universal and it doesn't really matter who, yeah, where who, it comes from. And yeah, that's the great thing with Joel was he was always very collaborative about it and willing to at least hear me out when I think a lot of people, yeah, in that situation would absolutely hate that, you mm-hmm. know, but he was really just, it was all song serving. It was like, is the song good? Then that's it. You know, it didn't matter if who it was coming from or where it was coming from. So
totally.
Yeah. Yeah, so I guess then we'll, you know, take it up to where our paths kind of,
yeah,
for the first time kind of crossed, which I don't, you know, I don't know exactly when that was. I mean, I guess we were playing local,
yeah,
local,
well, the
shows.
I mean, I saw your
at the sets and
totally. I mean, the thing I remember, so I remember your first show, so I remember, which I was at by accident. promoting our show.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, we were promoting our show and a friend of ours was like, hey, you gotta come in right now. This Providence is playing. Yeah. And I was like, and at that time I was just so into like the local scene of things that I had no, yeah, perspective on who that was or what that was. And it was a friend of ours, his name's Trevor. I haven't seen Trevor in a while. Hope he's okay. Trevor was in this band called Raining and Okay, and he got us in because he was promoting the show. He, yeah, was like handing out flyers too, yeah, and he was in it. Or the next day he was in it, his band or something like that. So we watched the show and then you guys played and it was so evident right away that like
we didn't know what the fuck we were doing.
Well, I mean, no, what was so, you know, even then I've told this story before, but even then I felt like I knew that was a different what you guys were trying to do in terms of connecting with people was so different than what everyone else was trying to do at that time. And I think that really excited me because I was like, oh, here's a band really trying to do this thing. Like bigger, it's a bigger thought. And that even more so even at that time than what This Providence was doing. I loved what This Providence was doing, but I think, yeah, in terms of connecting with people, it was a different thing. It felt relatable, even for whatever the genre was at that time or what you were writing or whatever it, mm-hmm, was. It felt relatable to people at that point to where that was exciting for us to be, for me as being in another local band to be like, hey, we should be doing shows with them because this is a thing that could be really connected. Like it really could feel special. It could feel like a culture. It could feel larger than the songs. And that was really exciting to me,
you know,
early on.
And then, you know, this century kind of is the start of what 8123,
yeah,
has become, and you know, kind of the start of
that whole thing
of,
yeah,
of all of this of, yeah, our being independent and you know all this stuff. And so you guys started working with Tim,
yeah,
and then through that we had signed to Warner Brothers and got this deal where we could bring in other bands and yeah, I just remember like early on it just being like so exciting that like, you know, it was like we were like a team almost. You know? It was like both bands like trying to like
do this thing
work for the same thing. It's like we're like on a team, which is kind of what like 8123 has been all about. You know, the whole time, and like that was like early on. You know.
Yeah, I think that was what was interesting then. I mean, and it still applies now, is that it was like at a point in working in the quote unquote music business, that I feel like there wasn't a lot of team playing at that time.
Yeah.
Like it was a lot about you had these artists, and these artists, maybe you had the same agent or maybe you had the same manager, and that's the only connection you had to the other artist in mind. And the only way they supported each other was like, you know, very vaguely, or they knew each other, but there was no communication of it. And it was pretty
What can you do for me?
Right. It was a lot about like, could you do a favor without getting one in return and feel okay about that? Yeah. And most of the people would say no. And so here we were in a situation where there wasn't that feeling. It was kind of just like, we're doing this and no one can tell us otherwise, because the platform existed to not tell us otherwise. You know, like the platform had been created that people were like, oh, maybe there is another way. Way before a lot of these things happened, to where now it's like you might hear some of that now, whereas then it was like so far into the point where you did kind of feel like you were on an island. So the fact that we did have the support was what kind of helped. It was like a nice glue to holding all these kind of crazy things together, because you get tossed around a lot in that side of things, and there's a lot more dark than light. And so,
well, and I think we both ended up being tossed around a lot by the end of that
story, but
at the beginning it seemed like
it almost seemed a little too good to be true. Yeah. Like it almost seemed a little like it almost had this feeling of that, like you were going into something with an expectation that had no basis in reality other than your own, which was what made it so exciting.
Yeah.
But yet at the same time, you didn't feel like it wouldn't work. Mm-hmm. You just felt like maybe the people involved couldn't rally around it in the same way you could. Yeah. But you could still see it through. And that's the part that was like, we never, if you don't doubt that, you don't ever have to worry about it failing, you know? Yeah. So
how did it feel kind of going from being a local band that had the dream of touring and being on a record label and all this stuff, and then you go and you're, you know, in this office at Warner with, you know, these A&R people that have signed, you know, the biggest artists in the world, and then you're co-writing and you're making a record and all these things, like, did it feel like, oh man, like my childhood dream is coming true? Like,
yeah, I think partially there was definitely that feeling of like, this is the thing. This is it. We were staying, you know, we had our own little apartment together, and we were working with this incredible producer who was making our first record. His name is Tim. And he really,
yeah, and I kind of want to like walk through the making of that record.
Sure.
So so from the beginning, you guys signed to Warner under our imprint.
Yeah.
And then the first thing to do is you guys are going to,
we're going to write for a really long.
Write songs with anyone and everyone.
Sure. And that was like the thing was, for a while, it was like, okay, go. They came to us and they said, I remember the meeting. We sat in that Warner office and they said, give me every single song you've got. And we were like, we're going to work so hard. We're going to write everything. We wrote like 50 songs. 50 really, really strange songs. And I remember getting the email back and literally them liking one of them. And the feeling of that was so soul crushing, to the point where you were just like, what do you mean you only like one song? How do you only like one? I mean, I listen to 50 songs in a day. I know that I like more than one of them. I mean, even if I don't like them, I feel like I like them. And so there was like a really weird feeling of like, oh, we had quote unquote made it, you know, like whatever that means. And yet we had no idea on the direction of it, and we had no real vision, because I didn't know how to make a record. I had no idea. I knew how to make songs, and I knew how to like show up and be like, these are the songs and let's play them. But I had no idea what a record meant until, you know, the start of this process. And we were going on all these writes, and they were
Were there any that were particularly bad or particularly good?
Like, my two. What's the, yeah.
Let's go there.
Yeah.
And kind of like set the tone for what it is that you're doing. Sure. If people don't understand, like a co-write.
So like oftentimes a co-write consists of usually one or two of the band members go into a room with another songwriter or songwriters, and you oftentimes will work from scratch and create a song together and try and base the goal of the day is to create a song that day or within 2 days and from start to finish, lyrics, melody, the whole bit, and then use that song as a catalyst to then either A, write other songs, or B, use that as kind of the spotlight song to get your record greenlit and start the process of writing songs around that song. Like that's the one, that's the quote unquote single, you know? And so
What band did the label want you to be?
Who? I mean,
did they say, because they when we had done it, it was like Tom Petty. So everyone would come in with the American Girl drum beat just going.
Really?
Yeah. Did that happen?
No, because that was the thing. You guys were way further on because you guys had vision without realizing you had vision. You know, at times, like I could tell it was a main song. At that time, I didn't know what a This Century song was. I just knew that I was writing songs. And that's why I think we got sent on those writing things. The goal of those trips are to hopefully through self-discovery of writing and collaborating, someone else hearing something within you or bringing something out in you to help you find that vision, to help you figure out what is the sound that makes you you. Yeah. And what you end up finding a lot of times on those trips is you know more about yourself through the failure of writing songs with people that are either, you know, so gifted at songwriting that they write a song without trying and it has nothing to do with you. You are totally bypassed in the process and they just write you a great song and then you feel no connection to it, or you strike gold and you hit this thing and it like now becomes your identity because you don't have enough confidence to say no or yes or whatever. No. That's the thing with those trips was we had no there was no personality in it because I think I was just absorbing.
Yeah. And not which is exactly what happened to us, you know, because for both of our bands during that time period, for Black and White and the Sound of Fire records, is that those are the only times that we have since then, you know, written songs with other people. Sure. to make a record. Everything else is just we just get in a room and yeah. we write songs, and it's just very like it feels like you're going through a machine.
Oh, yeah.
Rather than you're just like making your artistic your piece, your album, and it's very like we have to have a certain song that the label says is a single that can be played on the radio.
Yeah.
And we can't even decide who we're going to record with or get a date or anything until that one happens.
Yeah. The sense of timing of things when it comes to like getting the record greenlit is such a bizarre time because oftentimes, or at least in our case, we were so uncomfortable. We were already so uncomfortable, and then we had to make the biggest decision. Mm-hmm. There was no sense of like there was no solid ground in it, and the only thing that they were wanting was this one song, you know, one song to rally around as the defining thing for
your
whole career.
Which is such a vague.
Just such a vague thought because, I mean, I've woken up and been like, man, I'm going to do this today. And then I did it and I thought it was the greatest thing ever, the greatest idea. Turns out to be so awful. And then I could have based – and that's basing a whole career around that. So the thing that was interesting was when we first started making that record or trying to make that record was we were looking for a producer. And so we met this amazing producer. His name is Matt Wallace and he did – Maroon 5 songs about Jane, and he's done Train and a million records, and he's really brilliant guy, and he had us come out to his studio, and he actually had flown out to his show. He flew out. That's the first time we'd ever experienced that, someone flying out to see your show. What is that? That's like so movie that it's not even real.
Yeah, we went out to eat with him. And
went out to eat. Yeah, got some Mexican food with him. Yeah. He was a really nice guy.
Oh, you went to that?
Yeah Pat was at that.
I was there.
You were around a lot with their.
He was. Yeah. Yeah.
I was during that first album especially.
Totally.
I was kind of the.
You were as much an A&R as we had.
Yeah, I was kind of the like liaison between the record label and the band, kind of.
Sure.
And you were 22.
Maybe I don't think I was that old.
I think you were like 12, 19. 13, yeah. Yeah. No, they. I remember after that meeting. So we go to Los Angeles and we sit with him. And the thing that he did that really was interesting, he listened to all our demos and he said, this is the first person that said, hey, the demos aren't bad. They're not bad. And I was like, they're not? He's like, everyone's been telling you the demos are bad. He's like, no. Yeah. He's like, I like. And then he plays us three songs that he likes.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't even tell us the ones he didn't like. He only played us the things he liked. He's like, here's the three I like. Then he hands us this piece of paper. I will remember this to the day.
I was there. I remember this exactly.
It blew my mind. He hands me a piece of paper with a list of 100 of the greatest songs of all time. And when, at what time in those songs the chorus starts? At what second the chorus starts?
And they were all pretty much the same.
They were all pretty much the same.
It was like 39 seconds. 30, or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, yeah. Something between 39 and 50. I don't remember. Yeah. I should. You know what? In retrospect,
where's this fucking paper?
I can't find it. He fucking gave me the paper. I can't.
That's the secret. Get us that goddamn paper.
We're going on a treasure hunt for this.
Oh my gosh. This paper. Matt Wallace's famous songwriting paper. No, but I just loved it because it was the first tangible evidence of someone not criticizing the song, mm-hmm. not asking me what the song is about, just saying, this is a piece of paper with how much time this is when it should happen. And that really blew my mind that, like, there were other ways to think of songwriting other than, and not even that I agree with it, just that the idea existed that people were thinking about songs like that. Yeah. And I just kind of remember walking out of there and just staring and being like, huh. But in that meeting, right as we're about to leave, he goes, hey, you know, I saw you got more writing trips coming up. And at that point, we had written with like 10 people, and we were so burnt out. That's what happens with these trips. By the end of it, you know, you're so exhausted from writing average songs that you're just like, I don't really know what I want to do. I just want – it ended up just being like a catalyst to go write more, right? And he goes, hey, I saw on your list you're writing with this guy Tim Pagnotta, and you should definitely do that one. Because we were thinking about canceling the last couple because we were just so exhausted. And he goes, you should definitely do that one. I guarantee you it will be different than all the other ones you've done. And at that time, I mean, I didn't know anything about Tim. I didn't even know what band he had been in before. And so I was like, okay, well, if Matt's saying it and Matt just gave us this whole spiel about how to write songs, I'm going to at least see this through because if he's validating it, it's got to be something interesting. He totally wouldn't make a point to. So we cancel the other two and just keep Tim's. And then I remember the day we pull up to his house. It was the first house we had been to. Everything else was like a studio.
Yeah.
He was the first house we rolled up to. Very a quaint house in Pasadena. And we get inside and he's just like making macaroni and cheese. He's just sitting there at his like kitchen just like making mac and cheese.
Oh, hi,
and
Sean.
He's so nice and didn't ask a single question about our band or our songs or anything. He just like asked us like what we've been doing, like just really casual, really normal. And, you know, come to find out he had been in this band called Sugar Cult, who I really thought was great, but I had no idea that it was, you know, his band or anything. And I think that like the lack of preconceived notions about that maybe or fate or whatever brought it there. And we just spent like a day just like talking about music and talking about vibe and what it meant to be in a band. And there was something relatable about like, here's the first guy that like has really done it, has like been through the ringer and knows exactly what we've just gone through from a band perspective. And it felt so real and not bullshit. And after everybody telling you that this is the smash, this is the banger, this is the single, he's like, let's just write something. And so we literally just like, he grabbed an acoustic and we just played acoustic guitar for like 3 hours, just jamming stuff. Like,
That's awesome.
not even not even like anything, like really like whatever.
Where all the other writers, it's really fancy. There's beats and there's this and there's that.
Oftentimes in
these bros, you need a coffee? My assistant could get us one.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that. What was cool is that after that, we kind of didn't have something kind of jiving. And then he's like, let's go to 7-Eleven. It was just so casual. And then he ends up kind of just like, we end up jamming. And then we started doing what ends up being like the beginning riff for our song, Sound of Fire. I start playing it on guitar and he just kind of starts like jamming. Like it felt like a fifth member. It felt like a band. Mm-hmm. Felt like he was just part of the band and it was helping us kind of like notice the things about us being in a band that were cool. It was okay to be just us. And it was so fun. We literally, cried laughing from that session. The worst lyrics, the funniest stuff. And we end up leaving that day and going like, I don't think I've ever had that much fun doing anything with songs, ever. Yeah. I don't know how I would do it differently. I don't know how, you know. And then it became, we record the demo. And we sent the demo over to Craig at the time, who was our A&R, and Tim and you. And it was like, oh, that's cool.
This is awesome.
This is really awesome. It sounds like a band. It sounds like you guys. It sounds fun. And then
that kind of became what that record was.
That record was.
And you guys wrote the whole record in that same way, you know?
And it
went from taking forever to then very quickly.
Yeah, it like almost hit like fast forward. It was almost like it almost snapped everything into place. It was almost like, wow, there's a more, you know, if it works on a, I think there's like that dumb adage of like, if it works on acoustic, it'll work in any production model, which is really funny now thinking about that. But in a way, in that way, it really did. It was like, it didn't even matter. And then we literally called up, I remember calling up Tim and being like, hey, so could we go and make a record with Tim Pagnotta instead? And we kind of got Tim Pagnotta as a producer through Matt Wallace, even though we were already like ready to go with Matt Wallace. I mean, there were like legitimate discussions of Matt Wallace making the record.
Yeah.
Like numbers were thrown around, dates were thrown around, and it switched.
Yeah.
And we just like took it, and he was so cool about it. I remember him telling, like giving the good wishes of like so happy that Tim was doing it.
Yeah.
And that was such a big deal because at that time, Tim, he's since gone on to produce some wonderful records, some really big records, and at that time he hadn't really
like, it was like he had that one Neon Trees.
He had just the Neon Trees at the time. Yeah. And even when he was writing with us, he didn't even have that song.
Yeah.
The Animal, which ends up I was talking to Garrett the other day about this. He showed me the demo to Animal before it was done. And he was like, hey, check this out. And he just showed it to me and I was like, what is that? That's a big song, Tim. Yeah. I remember like knowing from the demo that it was a big song and him going like, yeah, I don't know. Like the label, they like it, but I don't know. Because he was still just didn't have the cuts like he does now. And he literally, the next like 2 weeks later, we're in the car and it's on the radio.
It's a big song.
And so that kind of changed while we were working on our record and we were like, well, wait a second.
Maybe this can happen to us,
you know?
And, like 2 weeks later, we'll have a hit.
Yeah, and in
39 seconds, the chorus comes in.
And in like classic major label fashion, which I think like happened to us a little bit too. But so you guys go and you have this like amazing experience.
Yeah,
and you make the record and it's like so fun and it feels like all the hard work is like finally coming together.
Sure.
And then now there's this one other thing, which I haven't even talked to you all that much about, but so. Then like the record's done and then To Love and Back.
Yeah.
The song which was on the EP before, Craig the A&R who was, you know, a great A&R guy and really really good with songs, but he was obsessed with the song.
Yeah, it became like his project. Baby. It was his project was not the band. His project was that song.
Yeah.
And that's how I felt. And the thing is that song, you know, even when I showed that song to like Tim Pagnotta when we first did it, he didn't want to touch it. He liked it how it was. And that was like, okay, so, but Craig's insisting that we redo this and put it on the record. And he's like, okay, well, we can try, but we've got to do something to it to change it because the energy of it's really great and it doesn't seem like it needs to be messed with, you know? And then in classic major label fashion, it became, okay, well, how can we make this, blow this one up? How can we make this the big song? And so we literally chased this song into the ground for a while.
I mean, it ended up working
with JR.
With JR, who was a big pop producer at the time.
Yeah.
And spent $50,000.
Yeah, $50,000
on a, basically a...
glorified remix.
A remix,
yeah,
of To Love Him Back, to put in the record, which was as much as the rest of the album cost.
Yeah.
So for one song, or a remix of one song, $50,000 was spent to do this, which, like, now seems insane.
Actually,
you guys were kind of, you know, and us kind of along the last lines of, like, that money
being
that kind of money
way.
Being tossed around for, like, art,
bullshit.
Art for art types of bullshit bands.
Yeah.
I mean, like, we've told the story before where they flew out Jared to LA to do a bend in the course of Right Girl,
but
and just to give people context, I'm going to grab a guitar and hand it to one of you, and we're going to show people how long it took Jared to record this part, and they paid for plane tickets.
Yeah, he has what, a bend? I'm doing a bend.
Yeah, just bend the guitar.
So hold on, so. So our album is almost done, right? Our album's almost done, and they decide that this part is just gonna make it so much better. And there already is like a recording of it, but just the part isn't good enough. So they pay for plane tickets and hotels, and then this is what gets added. That's it. And that's it. And then he goes back home.
The rest is history.
So that's like, so when
and
you
then
look,
we had
so,
a hit.
Yeah. So when you listen to Right Girl, there's a $5,000 bend. And then when you listen to the Century record, the $50,000 remix hasn't been heard.
The best part of that story of all time, my favorite part of that story, it's like the most, like, I think it encapsulates the experience of like the final hurrah of that, is that right after we finish the record, I tell Tim Pagnotta, I say, hey, they're going to do the JR thing. Joel's just going to track the vocal with JR. So Joel goes without me, which I was like, so at that time, my ego about that was like so stupid. Yeah. I was like, what do you mean I can't be there for the vocals? I got to help him.
I'm
like,
the fucking
like
guy.
Like as if I'm the guy. Like as if that's a real thing.
These are my words.
These are, yeah, come on, man. He goes and records these vocals. We get back to the hotel room. At that point, we were out of our apartment. We were like way over our stay in Los Angeles. I mean, we had been there for 4 months at that point.
I remember
that. And I'm in the hotel room, and I get a call from Tim. And there's something about when a Tim Kirch calls you, and there's a tone in his voice when he knows he's got to break bad news to you, but he also needs you to be like able to like see through the idea bigger than the initial impact of how sucky it's going to be, which is the like, hey, so you can just like hear right away.
I was about to say
he's
that.
It's not going to be ideal. And he goes, here's the deal. There's a remix, but the song's done, but I'm going to send it to you, but just don't say anything yet. Just listen to it. Take your time with it. We get the song back and I turn it on and we're all excited because we thought this is going to be like the big thing. You know, like they spent all the money. This is
JR.
This is JR. This is like the guy who just had a very big song with the Ready Set, with everybody. I mean, so many pop artists and
Jason Derulo.
Yeah. And so we get it back and the first part of the song is the same guitar part from the Jason Derulo song. Verbatim, he put it into the. He chopped up our guitar part in the beginning of the song. Which in the beginning of the song, it's got this like piano riff that's like dun, 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 dun. And he put guitar part. He chopped it up the same way as In My Head by Jason Derulo. And I remember listening and going like, can he do that? Is he allowed? Is that allowed? And it's so funny that like, and then because of how crazy everything is, I can't even ever show people other than like friends. I can't show people how ridiculous that song sounds because Warner Brothers, I think, technically owns it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I can't, but I definitely want to show it. I think it's a great, like, it should be shown in like classes of like, see, this is what could happen.
Watch out.
Like, people can just do whatever they want, even if they don't understand what you are, you know?
Is there a bunch of like, pew,
there's a record scratch on it. Like a full,
are you fucking kidding me?
There's a record scratch. There is a bunch of like really crazy 808s that like just would blow your mind. Yeah, but it's pretty great.
Yeah. So that's, yeah, I think that's really interesting because it's like probably the last of any of ours like excess in the music industry. Like that's like,
yeah,
the last experiment you're going to have with that. You know?
Yeah. And what was cool though, I think, is like, that experience kind of changed the course of the whole thing, though.
It was like, okay, we all want to do the opposite of this.
Yeah, whatever this is, not that, you know? And then that became like, let's just tour. Let's just find a way to tour. Let's just find a way to like actually make real sounds for real people and see what that consists of. And that kind of spurred the whole like touring for 2 years straight of, you know, just trying to explain to people what the heck we were, you know? Which is a weird thing. It's a weird conversation to like have with people to be like, no, this is us. And then you have to like do it like four times before people are like, oh yeah, I kind of see what you mean. Okay. I like this thing.
Yeah. And I mean, and I, you know, during that time after the record came out, I mean, we had some amazing times and played awesome shows
crazy
together.
Shows. Yeah.
And you know, you guys had this freak kind of thing where you got really big in the Philippines.
That was wild.
You know, and had all these great amazing things happen.
Sure.
And then like after that, after putting out a couple records and stuff, do you like remember the first time that you felt like maybe it was time to be done with that like chapter of your life?
Totally. Well, what happens is like we were very, I'd like to preface it with that we were really lucky, because a lot of bands kind of don't realize that like the creative momentum is disappearing until it explodes and it becomes personal, you know? Mm-hmm. And at that point, what had happened was like, I didn't know what else to say. Like I really hit a wall where I was like, I don't know what else to really communicate right now, you know, through this, in this way. And we all kind of agreed. Like we wrote this record called Soul Sucker. And I was really proud of it because we really didn't know what we were doing with that thing. Like it was long, and it was like us searching to try and see if we could kind of piece it together. And through that, realizing like, hey, we do this. This is fun. I love this. We're all so close at that point. And I could feel the songs not feeling natural. Mm-hmm. Like it feeling like I was really just writing a song to write a song. And that's when it starts to feel like it's not, you know, it's not working anymore. And I remember finishing the record and going like, and getting on a call with Joel and Ryan and just being like, yeah, I don't know where else to take this. And also it's like, I'm tired. I'm like, we were really exhausted because we had gone through some really crazy ups and downs, as like every band does. But like, to the point where it was exhausting, where it kind of deflates the balloon a little bit. But like also being like, hey, we finished a record. Somehow we did another record. Let's put the record out, let the fans enjoy it for what it is, and then move on from there, you know? Yeah. And not have it be this like dark kind of weird thing, and let everybody just kind of like find themselves again, you know? Because I never had a chance. I feel like, you know, there's that weird thing where it's like, if you don't take time to find yourself through being in a band, you often lose yourself in the band to the point where you forget that you have to be a person too. You have to be a person to, you have to be a friend to other people outside the band, and you have to be, you know, conscious of other things. Yeah. Or you start
tour can be, and being in a band, and you know, it can be just a, like, you can get stuck, like, mentally, in headspaces that other people aren't, because they're continuing on with their life. And in a lot of aspects, you like grow a lot more than other people do quicker. But then in a lot of aspects, you're kind of like stuck.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's like, it almost feels like,
and you have to really make an effort to not be that way.
And I think the thing that's unusual about being in any sort of creative atmosphere, whether any sort of place where you're being vulnerable, is that when people tell you every day how lucky you are and how you know, and how wonderful it is to be doing the thing you're doing, but yet you're not feeling that because you, whatever you're going through, you're still a real human.
Totally.
And mm-hmm. you and no one understand, not no one, that's being really broad, but a lot of people don't understand that there's like a sense of like, maybe I'm not really that, I'm not feeling the way it's being projected because I'm not ready to actually get rid of that vulnerability as a person, even if mm-hmm. I'm putting it on the page. And some people don't understand that and they think you're fine always, you know, because mm-hmm. that's, you're projecting a certain thing. And so for me, that was the problem, is like I did a really bad job of communicating that maybe I didn't really know myself as well as I thought I did because I was just so busy creating things for either other people or creating things that were a version of myself, but not my actual self. And so that's where it got kind of like, oh, maybe I just need to actually listen. I stopped listening, you know? I was only doing and I wasn't listening,
mm-hmm.
you know?
But, yeah, that's like the challenging thing that it, you know, and it sounds so weird to like, you know, talk about any bad aspects of yeah. like of being in a band. I think like a lot of musicians as well, like this doesn't get talked about because people feel bad to like
yeah.
to like say anything that isn't that right. that makes it hard because on the surface it seems like you're living a dream.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
And it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean it's not really hard and
yeah.
that
well and you're not, you still have emotions. You still yeah. feel things.
Yeah.
Like what I see happening now is like I feel like younger I felt like I was older than like my friends at home.
Yeah.
And now I'm getting the thing where it's like, I feel I'm getting, like we've said a few times, it's like, I'm staying the same age and everyone, like people having kids and getting married
yeah.
and like living yeah. real lives. Yeah. I grew up fast and then I stuck there.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah.
And what, you know, what's hard is like, okay, so you go through a breakup or your grandparents die, yeah. but you're on tour.
Yeah.
And you can't really take the time to grieve because you're always around other people
sure.
and you're always like, you know, talking to fans after shows and doing other things. So you kind of like suppress all these things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then over time, it just like drains you. You
yeah.
know?
Well,
and it gets exhausting, which is like
yeah.
why I think all of us now are, you know, with you, you know, now being the Technicolors and us, it's like learning better balance of like how
sure.
how to do both, like how to have like a normal life and
yeah. well, and also I think the thing that is really tricky is that when you put yourself out there and put your art out there and people start to take a sense of you know, loosely saying ownership over it in the sense that it becomes part of their life in some mm-hmm. way, whether it's emotionally or just for fun or whatever it is, it becomes part of their routine and they're part of their, you know, you are a part of their world as much as they're a part of yours in different ways, you know? And then there's an expectation that maybe, you know, sometimes people feel like, oh, if you say you're grieving for some reason and then they want to, you know, give you their condolences and all that stuff. It's like, yeah, you can feel that and you can like, and you can absorb that for what it is. But at the same time, you're also like, it feels like it's a weird feeling to have to like take that and absorb that feeling and feel like you're okay with that. And it's just,
maybe yeah. you're not ready to be,
you're not ready to.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so but you don't get a choice.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that I don't think people, not that they don't respect it, but they sometimes misunderstand it. That people might be going through way more than, it's really easy to assume things, I think I've learned, and
yeah.
way harder to just listen.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, I mean, I think that's just something that constantly you have to work at. Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah just keep getting better. And it's something that I've, you know, there was a time, you know, I was just so obsessed with this and only this.
Sure.
And I didn't leave room for anything else. I didn't think I could be in a relationship because I was like, oh, well, then I can't do what I do for the band. And then it's like, oh, then you try it and you're like, oh, wait,
yeah.
like I can do both.
Sure.
You know, it's like, obviously I like need to do, I need to do both a lot better,
yeah.
but like it's possible, you know, and you start to like do things to make yourself happy. And then you realize like, wait, we can still do this, and I can still like put in all this effort and be great to our fans, and you know, we can make great records and we can be people.
Yeah. I think that it's literally that you feel like you, for a second, like you weren't, you almost have to like find yourself. You have to, through that, like through that experience of going like, oh, okay, maybe just because I'm good at something doesn't mean that I have to do it all the time. I can be good at multiple things, and I can also give that time out to people.
That's a huge thing.
Yeah. Which is why
you
like,
feel like you can't, sometimes you feel like you can't do something else because you feel like if I give something else to cooking, like you're good at cooking, but like.
Love the cooking.
But like.
Shout out Guy Fieri.
You can kind of feel like maybe if you give it somewhere else, you can't give it fully to the
thing,
you know,
and you know, which is why even just like simple things, which seems so dumb, like you know, we're about to end this in a second to go play basketball, you know, and we have this like 81-23 basketball league where it's just like a bunch of us get together and play every Tuesday, things like that really are incredible for the mind and for like it's just like, hey, this takes 100% of your focus and you can only focus on this one thing, and it has nothing to do with, you know, I think Mark from Taking Back Sunday, watching our dressing room the other day at the holiday show we did with them, and we were just talking and he's like, yeah, we're like off tour for a while and I'm getting bored, and he's like, you know, when your hobby becomes your job, then what the fuck do you do?
Yeah.
And I think like that is kind of what the past couple years for all of us
have felt like,
have been like figuring that out.
Yeah.
And like finally getting in a place where it's a better balance and more comfortable.
Yeah.
And that's why the whole 81-23 thing and this whole culture and doing the festival and like everything has gotten so much better. And at the same time,
but yeah,
we all are like, are happier. You know?
Yeah. Well, and I think the only reason I was able to like move on to a different situation, the reason I chose to go back into another band all the stuff again was the condition that, okay, if I'm going to do this again, I'm going to come into it with a very different head, and I'm going to do it because for that exact reason, which is it needs to somehow still feel like a hobby. Like even if it's not, it needs to like, you need to trick yourself into feeling that way, because then it feels like that when the pressure's off is when the magic happens, you know?
Yeah,
and then that's why the whole reason that I continue to do it is that I found a way to trick my brain into feeling like I'm, you know, 15 and doing it all over again. And that's why I feel special again, you know? Yeah. So,
well, we're all pretty lucky, I think, to be able to be, to be doing this.
Well, this podcast is brought to you by your feelings.
Thanks for getting very emo with us at the end there.
There we go.
Basketball.
Yep. Yeah.
One basketball.
Spaldings with a Z.
We appreciate their support. Basketballs.
And we will talk to you all soon.
Goodbye.
Thank you.
Bye. Thanks, Sean. Yeah.